I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:39 p.m. on Thursday, March 19th, 2026. Present today, we have Representative Allard, Representative Moore, Representative Bynum, Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Shragi. Also here today to support our committee is Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lastufka, Secretary Bree Wiley, Secretary Leah Frazier, and LIO Moderator Emily Mesh. And we've just been joined by Co-Chair Josephson as well. Today, we will hear a presentation from the Alaska Energy Authority by Executive Director Curtis Thayer and Chief Operations Officer Tim Sandstrom. We will then move to an introductory hearing for House Bill 210, Peace Officers, Firefighters, Disability by Representative Kopp. With that, Director Thayer and Mr. Sandstrom, please come up to the testifiers table. Oh, just Director Thayer.
I think he's shy today.
Very good. That's just fine. Probably not the only one feeling that way today. Director Thayer, thank you for being with us. If you could put yourself on the record and begin with your presentation when you're ready.
All right. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Curtis Thayer, and I serve as the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And today, what we wanted to give you was a AEA rail belt transmission update with also some other stuff for with rural Alaska, but kind of focusing on the priority items on the rail belt. A little bit about AEA. Many of you know we have seven distinct areas. We have owned assets, which is primarily our discussion today, which is the Bradley Lake Hydro Project, the Alaska Intertie, which is between Willow and Healy, the Sterling to Quartz Creek, which is down on the Kenai Peninsula, and then also the Cook Inlet Power Link, which is the one to be built. In addition, we do are responsible for the Power Cost Equalization Program. It's approximately $46 million that helps establish the rates between basically 20 cents to 75 cents and provides that difference into rural Alaska. So their costs are similar to the rail belt cost. That does affect about 81,000 Alaskans. And in addition, we do rural energy bulk fuel upgrades, as well as rural power system upgrades. We also have a program called Circuit Rider, where we have individuals that travel in rural Alaska, as we tend to be the 911 call for several communities. So we provide training, and if the lights are out, we will make go out there in an emergency situation, provide emergency assistance. We do have a renewable energy program where we do biomass, electric vehicles. We've talked about several times. We have $37 million from the federal government for electrical vehicle. We partner with the Department of Energy or Department of Transportation with that program. And then in addition, there are two large programs, home energy and high efficiency rebate allocations. That's $74 million. No state match is required, and that we're partnering with the Alaska Housing on those programs. We also have the Renewable Energy Program, as well as the Power Project Fund, and then also several federal grants to the tune of almost $500 million. We also provide energy planning through our Energy Task Force, and then security profile, which is a requirement of the Department of Energy. And then we have a lot of forward, all everything we've done in the last 50 years, we have forward facing on an electric data library. So if you want to find out whether the state invested in something 35 years ago, you can find out. You want to know something on Susitna-Wantana, we have $200 million worth of FERC permits and all the work done online and easily available. And then we have the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, the RTO, which was from legislation. The legislature and the governor passed 2 years ago. And there's a little bit of slide on where we're at with that process. The two major projects here today is our status overview on the Bradley Lake expansion, which is about a $400 million project. We've raised to date $20.7 million for pre-construction. Thank you. It's the Alaska Legislature who we raised the money from over several years and several different tranches. Funds needed is about $400 million, and we'll talk a little bit more about it, but we are looking in Washington, D.C. for some low-interest loans that several programs have, Department of Energy, Energy as well as the Department of Agriculture. And then the second item is the Cook Inlet Power Link, which is the known as the GRIP, also the HVDC cable, which happens to be an example here on the corner of the table, what that HVDC cable is. Just to put it in comparison, that weighs about 30 pounds, and we need 80 miles of it. And so we need quite a bit of a line, and look at the copper center in that alone. Raised to date is $270 million, and the funds still needed is $142 million. With Bradley Lake, like I said, the total cost we anticipate to be $400 million. We are also working with the Department of Treasury as it might qualify for up to $100 million in investment tax credits once the project is complete. They would write us a check for $100 million that we could apply against the debt on the project itself. And we will know what that, we will roughly know what that will be before we go into construction. So we can take that into account. But with this, with the Bradley Lake expansion, it would increase the hydro output by about 50%. It is already the largest, it already supplies 10% of the rail belt needs. They would go to 15%. And it would also require a dam raise of 16 feet. And the picture here actually is this last summer when we were doing some geotechnical work on the dam and doing drilling 1,000 feet deep to make sure that we could handle the dam raise. And right now we have submitted a draft amendment application to FERC. That is in a 4-month review, and then we'll do the formal submission. We've been working with FERC and met with all the FERC, all five FERC commissioners on this project, and we hope that we can get through the FERC process and be ready for construction in summer of 27, so just over a year from now, which would be great for us and a record-breaking pace for them. To do the project, but there is no opposition to the project at this time. And we've been working with the Board of Consultants for design and permitting, and we have secured enough money to complete the environmental studies that are currently underway. And this, the biggest with this is this will displace 1.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas in Cook Inlet, which is actually 7.5% of the unmet needs in Cook Inlet. And we would hope to have this completed by 2031. A lot has to do with the timing of FERC, but we're on schedule to do it. And what the diversion itself does is we raise the dam 16 feet, but we do a directional drill through a mountain, 16 feet in diameter. We will line it in concrete and then divert water from a receding glacier, Dixon Glacier, in the lake that's in front of it, and divert that into Bradley Lake to raise the dam, the water into the dam up additional 16 feet. One thing to keep in mind is the 35 years ago, from the dam down to the powerhouse, we already have a 13-foot diameter tunnel that was built. So it's been done before at that site. And the other interesting piece of this is we will not be using diesel. We will actually be using three-phase power from the dam to power the boring machine. So it's going to be no diesel on site. Saves quite a bit of money, and a lot of risk is then removed from the project.
A question from Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. Thank you for being with us today. And I want to just return real quick to page 3. Mr. Thayer, when we first started on the GRIP, Cook Inlet Power Link project, there were some deadlines and tranches of money that needed to be allocated in certain time frames. When's, besides the total funds still needed, when's the next tranche of money that we need to appropriate to make sure this project stays online?
Through the chair, I have a slide a little bit further back that might better define it, and I can explain it.
Okay, yeah, if you wanted to jump to, well, I guess we'll just wait till you get till 6, because I didn't see it in there of like just trying to figure out, because we haven't talked about it in an active verb tense in the last year or so. And I don't want to say it's not on our horizon because it's in the back of our head, but it's not a small ticket item. And so I want to just make sure that we are planting the seed to be in a position to have that money the next time we need to come up with some of that match money.
Okay, through the chair, let me just get to there because there's some other things happening at the same time that we're working on. So just let me get there real quick.
And then before we proceed, Representative Tomaszewski would also like in the queue.
Yeah, on the current slide. Thank you, Co-Chair. So the expansion, I know that our utility in Fairbanks has a certain percentage of the output from Bradley Lake. Are any of the percentages going to change as far as what is divvied up among the organizations that take the power? And I'm just assuming that we're going to get another, it's going to be 1.5 times what we're getting now.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative, we have an agreement with the utilities that we would use the current power sales agreement for the costs associated with Bradley, the expansion of Bradley. So the short answer is yes. Fairbanks currently receives 17% of the power or the water from Bradley. They would receive 17% from this. Chugach Electric is the largest, receiving 56%, so they have 56%. But, of course, at the same time, they would absorb 56% of the cost of the project, as Golden Valley would do 17%. Homer has, I think, 11%. Seward has 1%, and Matanuska Electric has 14% is the water. And so that's one of the things I'll talk about in a minute. As we look at financing options, the fact the utilities have backstopped, in essence, the funding or the how we're going to fund this project, it's drawn a lot more interest in D.C. of low-cost loans that might be available to us.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, very good. Please proceed.
The timeline for Bradley expansion project, it's just we are 2025 and 26, so while FERC is reviewing the application, we're still completing some of the geotechnical work and still meeting with the Board of Consultants. But what you do see is definitely in 2028 is a spike as far as needing funding through actually 2030. And with that, this is where we're looking at some low-cost options I'll be bringing up in a moment for Bradley funding. The Cook Inlet Power Link, it's a $413 million project. We do have the Department of Energy with a $206 million grant. There is match of 64.2. The legislature has provided 14.2. AEA with the utilities have provided a $50 million bond. And so what we're short is $142 million, which is a considerable amount of money, but also for a project of this size with two-thirds of the money literally in the bank. We're in a pretty good position. What this does is does 38 miles subsea cable times two across Cook Inlet, which will hopefully give us up to 200 megawatts of bidirectional power flow. As far as March to 26, we've done preliminary engineering, environmental routing are complete, and the project is advancing to detailed design, permitting and procurement in alignment with the DOE. One thing I think it's important to note is we spent last summer from May to September going through DOGE to make sure this is a good project. And the outcome was two-thirds of the GRIP applications were denied. One-third was told to proceed. And we were actually told that we had one of the best projects in the country for the stage in which the development was because we had done the engineering, the procurement, and had that work done. And so we've been green-lighted as of September to go forward on the project. But there was a little bit of a pause during that time that we were waiting for them to do this. And we need to have a shovel-ready status, needing to have this complete by 2032 because that's the end of the grant, the $206.5 million. The Cook Inlet Power Link, the construction timeline, I think this goes to Representative Hannah's question, and that is when we look at 2425 was the time that we were going through the DOGE process, and now for the next 2 years, we have funding in the sense of that half that money, we have $64 million, the federal will match that. And so in 2026, 27 is when we start into spending. One of the large expense items that we have is this cable. We need to make a deposit and get in the queue to have it built, and it's going to be a 2 or 3 year lead item. And so that kind of puts us in the 28, 26 time period or 29 time period is because then you'll be bringing a ship in that we have to schedule a year in advance to actually lay the cable. So when you look at this time scale, one of the things that we've had talk with the Department of Energy about is they're like, you have $142 million. What's your line? You need $142 million. What's your line of sight on getting that? that funding. So that goes to when we need it definitely by FY28, but we're also looking at some opportunities in Washington, D.C. To avail ourselves up to maybe some low-cost funding for that. And I'll raise that in a moment.
Representative Galvin?
Thank you. Through the chair, Director Thayer, when you mentioned on slide 6 that you got through DOGE with one-third being proceed and then the two-thirds were denied, I didn't know what that meant.
My apologies through the chair. Two-thirds of the overall projects that Department of Energy granted got rescinded, and only a third of the projects were told to go forward. We were one of the one-third to go forward.
I see. Projects overall.
Right.
Okay, so I apologize. I did not hear you properly.
No, I apologize for that.
And then on the federal dollars, if I may have follow-up, please, the federal for FY28, are those dollars, are they loans that are good loans, or are they match dollars where you would expect some help?
Through the chair, they are match dollars. Mm-hmm. And we have enough because we have a $50 million bond that AEA and the utilities have, plus the $14 million the legislature has given. So we have $64 million, and the feds will match $64 million.
Thank you.
So they'll spend as we go.
Very good. Please continue.
As far as a team, we have expert partners. We've engaged Hunton Law Firm. They're looking at the tax credits. Like I said, could be worth up to $100 million on Bradley. ORIC is our bond advisors, have been for a long time. We have PFM, which is our public finance advisory and capital planning. So there will be a time with the presentation where we'll actually have a lot of from PFM laying it out. Dow is our primary engineer on the Bradley Lake Hydro project, and Stantec Engineering is our engineering firm for the Cook Inlet Power Link. So we've got some world-class partners here. This picture is actually a loan application that we're halfway through, and it's already 1,000 pages long for the Department of Energy. So it is not it's not like buying a house by any stretch of the imagination. They require a lot of information. As far as potential financial partners, not in any particular order, but the U.S. Department of Energy has energy dominance financing under Title 17. They normally fund projects over $1 billion. They are making an exception for us at $400 million plus. But with this is they provide funding. We can borrow money at Treasury rate, which is right now around 5%. And then they have fees about 3/8. And so that's one of those low costs because right now the market's 6.3. And so if we can get Treasury rate around 5%, definitely that's an advantage to us. The one is the U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA. They have their rural utility services, and they have what they call a system borrower program. And both Bradley Lake and the Cook Inlet Power Link both qualify for that program. And I should have mentioned the Department of Energy, Energy Dominance, the SIPLink program or the Across the Cook Inlet does not qualify because it was Department of Energy that gave us the $206 million. So they won't turn around and then give you a low cost interest for the match. So they don't double dip. But Department of Agriculture is one that we are also having conversations with. And ironically, AEA had a loan with them 40 years ago. And we paid it back, and so we now have become a borrower in good standing, and we automatically qualify. So we are in the process of applying for funding with them for, again, Bradley Lake and also Cook Inlet Power Link. And with them, they also do it at Treasury rate, but they do it at 1/8. Now, Department of Energy does 3/8, but Department of Agriculture would like to see their funding come back within the first 2 years, and Department of Energy allows us to start paying back after completion of, or after construction. So there's pros and cons to a time value of money. So those are some of the things we're looking at. Tax-exempt bonds, Bradley Lake, thanks to Senator Stevens, put in language that we do qualify for tax-exempt bonds just for Bradley, and we have gone to the municipal bond financing with the state. We have secured $342 million worth of bonds through the state for this. And again, whether we use them or not, again, it's part of what that capital stack would look like. And what we do for Bradley and what we do for Cook Inlet Power Link will be different, but because, like I said, tax exempts don't qualify for Coquitlam Power Link. We've also have borrowed money in the past from the National Rural Utilities Cooperative Finance Corporation. They're taxable bonds. That's market rate. And we have a commitment that they are interested in providing up to $200 million worth of financing for Bradley or the Cook Inlet Power Link or both. And then also the taxable bond market itself, which we have, AEA has access to, and that could be for Bradley Lake or the Cook Inlet Power Link. So for us, there's several, like I said, we're running several different modeling to figure out just what is the best program and how we're going to stack it, because obviously we want the low cost to the consumer. Again, you will notice that we have more restrictions on the Cook Inlet Power Link funding. We just don't have as many doors due to the fact that it was a federal grant that is in there. Bradley has no state money in it, no state appropriation or federal appropriation. Let me phrase it. There's no federal appropriation in it, so we don't have any restrictions of federal dollars on that one. But the utilities are backing that, so definitely there's interest when you already know who wants the power. We talked about the investment tax credit on Bradley. It may qualify for between 6 to 25% of the total project cost, which potentially could be up to $100 million. So in essence, if that cost is $400 million, at the conclusion, we would also need to have our capital stack in such a way that we could pay that $100 million. If we got a check for $100 million, we can pay it for that. It could be $24 million. We don't know, but we're determining that. One thing that is important to note too, which is if we go down and use tax-exempt bonds in our federal stack, then it could reduce our tax credits by up to 15%. So, you know, if we only get $24 million in tax credits, 15% is not that much. But if you think we're going to get $100 million, that's $15 million penalty. So we have to really see if that tax-exempt bond package works. And so those are some of the things that we're trying to identify and working towards. And we've made a commitment to our board to try to have this rounded out by July. And then when we do this, we would come up with a term sheet for our board to approve, and then take it to the utilities, be working with utilities at the same time, so they also have approval from their boards too. So we're all on the same page of how to finance Bradley or the Cook Inlet Power Link. As far as staging, the Bradley Lake is the priority because that could be into construction in 27. But we do have that 2-year lead time or funding available. So we would do the Cook Inlet Power Link immediately following that, which could be, I say immediately following, it could be in January or a year from now. We could be in those conversations. But right now we're running them simultaneously. And when I say we're running them simultaneously, the team of people doing this is 5, led by our general counsel.
And just let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Jimmy. Welcome. Please continue.
So at this point, I have more in my presentation, but this ends the Power Link and the Bradley Lake. So I just want to
see if there's Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. Director, I'm looking at slide 5, and that's the cost timeline. I'm actually trying to figure out, I think it's 2031 that you plan on having this finished. At one point in time, I recall hearing from Homer, I think, that that's where they were concerned about brownouts and real deep worries of lack of a contract, I guess, to get to the energy they need. If you're familiar with some of what those talks have been and what the solutions are, it looks like this may be coming in late to fix their deep concerns, or is there still some thought that this is going to likely be a good quick fix or faster than other fixes that we've been hearing about?
Through the chair. 2030 has been the kind of the market when we see the shift on gas contracts. When we say 2031, we're looking at first quarter 2031, and we're trying to be very conservative with the schedule. Our goal would be is if we could get it done in mid-2030, we want to do that. And that's one of the reasons why we're focusing on the funding and getting that in, hopefully in place this year. And then once we have the funding in place, the Bradley Lake, between the two projects, this is a, I don't want to say it's a simpler project to do, but aligning it up, we already done directional drilling. We need the equipment there and do the directional drill through 5 miles, but we've done that before, and then lining it. So it's a more straightforward project. Mm-hmm. And so this one, like I said, I don't want to put pressure on our team, but 2030, 31, but we want to be conservative on the 31 part. But we've had the conversations that if we can do this in 2030, we're going to do it in 2030.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon, did I see a hand go up?
I'm going to wait.
Okay, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrage, through the chair, to Mr. Thayer. Thank you very much for being here today. Really appreciate you bringing this. I think these are all very important projects. I think bringing stability through hydropower to Alaskans is a good thing. I was hoping that maybe that I don't see provided here is the story of what this actually means to the Alaskan ratepayer. So, I mean, here on finance, we see the big numbers, $400 million. We see the megawatt hours, which I don't think a lot of folks really understand what that really means. But on a long-term cost stabilization lens, what does this project really mean to the rail belt ratepayer?
Through the chair, first of all, we do owe the committee because we have PFM running numbers right now. As we determine, the biggest thing for us is we know what the cost of the project is. Our biggest number is what do we qualify for tax credits? Is it $24 million or $100 million? And so we've been actively working with the U.S. Treasury on and they've been very receptive in determining how we determine that. And then PFM will do that modeling so we know what the kilowatt cost is per customer. Right now, Bradley Lake Power is the cheapest in on the rail belt. For the most part, it's 4.5 cents. You know, Fairbanks has some cost as high as 26 cents, but 4.5 cents is what that power is. And so once we have some of those numbers, we'll narrow that down. But we're looking at it just increasing it just a couple of cents on the construction piece to that. So it will still be the lowest cost power with the expansion. But again, we owe that and we owe those numbers to you because, again, we are trying to determine the tax credit piece of it first and the stack. And so we hope to, I would say we're probably within 30 days of having those numbers. And we'll be more than glad to share them with the committee.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Okay.
Great. Not seeing any other questions. Please continue.
All right. Let me get to where I – we have the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, which I will say it was a gift from the legislature. Two years ago, one of the things it did, it gave AEA a new board of directors, one focused with focused members, not only in rural Alaska, but people on the rail belt and also financing projects. And so that this new board has been very helpful for that. But on the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, the governance committee represents the utilities and AEA, including the Rail Belt Reliability Council, as ex-official non-voting. We received our certificate to operate from the Regulatory Commission on May 6th. And on July 1st, the RTO filed a proposed open access transmission tariff. And that just concluded 4 weeks of hearings last week. There are 14 interveners. And so let's just say that at the end, and then the docket is pending with the RCA with a final order due on June 4th. But with 15 interveners, I honestly do not know if everybody's going to be happy with the outcome. And so we're going to wait and see. But then the proposed OAT, or the open access, is for a network integration transmission service that introduces kind of more of a tariff-based revenue mechanism because we have pancaking of rates. So depending on what system you're going through, you had additional cost added to that for the backbone transmission. And then once the OAT is approved and the tariffs are finalized, the RTO staffing and operating costs will be supported through the utilities. Right now, the state AEA is paying for the salaries of two people as we go through this process. But once we have the, once we know what the costs are, then the OAT will then recover those costs of those employees. But again, it's an open docket. But we are participating. And like I said, I luckily did not have to sit in the room for 4 weeks listening. But I do have members of my team doing that. One other topic is the Renewable Energy Fund, which we have round 17, which is last year, was six top ranked projects. In FY 27, we have round 18. There were 29 applications for a total of $41 million for consideration. In the past, we've had, we started this program back up about 5 years ago. It's averaged anywhere from $4 to $17 million. So we've never really funded the full 41. But we did give a list to the legislature. The REF program, the state has invested $333 million since inception in this program. There's over 110 projects that are operational and 56 more in development. And to date, it has displaced about 120 million gallons of diesel fuel a year. So it's a very successful program. We have, we've supported like alumni down in Southeast Alaska, Prince of Wales. The Bradley project, the Dixon Version, was a REF program, but 80% of the funding has primarily gone to rural Alaska. And so you can see that in Igiagig all the way up to Kotzebue, Bethel, and across the spectrum. And so it's been a very good program, successful program.
And Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Co-Chair Shragi. Mr. Thayer, round 18, $41.2 million in recommended projects, which is just slightly under all the, you know, rounds 13 to 17 combined. Maybe you've heard we're a little short of big dollar ticket money this year, even though we've got a new revenue forecast that gives us a little more. So within that $41.2 million, tell me where there are some tiers of project cutoffs, because I'm just speculating it's going to be really hard to get $41.2 million funded in this year's budget.
Yeah, through the chair, you know, since we started the program back up 5 years ago with round 13, the legislature's never been able to fully fund the recommended projects. And so the way the process is there's a Renewable Energy Advisory Committee. And so we go through an application process. AEA processes the applications. That also involves economic, technical review, DNR review. And so we come up with a ranking list, and then the REFAC, or the advisory committee, then makes the recommendations in the order in which it is. Traditionally, in the last 5 years, the legislature has a number in which they choose, or the governor has recommended a number, and they pretty much draw a line there and then fund above the line. And then what we've done generally is taken that second that was not funded and use that for the following year. These are good projects. Rather than have people do separate applications, then we offer the same list next year. So it gives the legislature, depending on funding, another bite at the apple. But the recommendations is just on the recommendations of the REFAC. But where the legislature wants to draw the line, that's completely up to you guys. It's not something that we have a recommendation on.
Follow up?
Yeah, I was looking. I was just given a note that there's an appendix that lists 15 projects. So I guess is the appendix on page 21 and 22 the totality of the 41 million? So I could just go down and say, forget, and I'm just pulling this out of the air. I've talked to no one about it. If I said I had 10 million and I can figure out if that gets me the top 3-4 projects, but then if I total them up and go, well, it's 10.4, so maybe that's where we need to go to round off to get a full project.
Yeah, through the chair, that's what's been done. The legislature's done in the past. And if I was asked the question, I would rather have you fully fund a project and draw the line rather than do partial funding, because Absolutely. Some communities are going to be short listed. Last year, the legislature funded 6 projects, and that's where they drew the line. This year, a couple of the projects are a little higher or cost a little bit more. We can do recommended funding up to $2 million if you're in a low-cost area, which is lower than the rail belt. If you're in a high-cost area, especially rural Alaska, then that limit is over $2 million. And so what you do see in the top 4, for example, is you have 2 rural and you have 2 urban, and then obviously more into rural going down. But again, just wherever the dollars land is where you can draw the line, and then next year you'll see that refreshed with the same list, but just those removed from it.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Couple of things next is rural power system upgrades. We have about $300 million in deferred maintenance. This program is for power generation in Alaska villages with fewer than 2,000 people. One of the things that we do is we're required and we prioritize projects based on system age, condition, and community risk level. And so you have Nelson Lagoon, which is a before picture on top, and you have Nelson Lagoon, which is an after shot that was done just recently. So there's quite a bit of difference you can see in the equipment when we do an upgrade and a full upgrade. Same is true when we do bulk fuel upgrades. You see Scammon Bay on the upper one. And if you notice, the tanks are not all standing up. There's not a containment field. A lot of issues and concerns. Scammon Bay now on the lower picture is the completely rebuilt Scammon Bay. A new powerhouse is about $6 million, and a new bulk fuel facility is about $11 million. So the prices do go up. Bulk fuel, there's more than 400 bulk fuel facilities in rural Alaska with over $1 billion in deferred maintenance, with an average of 40 plus years. But we had a little bit before and after, but this is a project that we've been tackling, for years. One thing that I'm very pleased with, and that is federal funding bulk fuel infrastructure. Last year, through the Denali Commission and partnering with Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the Alaska Village Electric Co-op, we were recipient of splitting $100 million federal grant from the EPA. With no state match required, you will see in the budget, there is a request for receipt authority to spend the money. But what this does, this is the single largest investment in over 20 years in bulk fuel. And we identified, they used the list that was used was our critical infrastructure list for bulk fuel. And AEA is responsible for 5 villages, and AVAC is doing 5. And we've already started work on that, and hope to have it completed by 2028. And we're working with the Denali Commission to hopefully see if EPA might have some more funds available to help us with this project. I will say Lee Zeldin, when he was in Alaska last year, he said his goal was to make sure that people in Alaska wanted to wear T-shirts that said, "We love the EPA," and I think we're looking for a place where we can buy those shirts because of the $100 million. I think a very good story is the USDA Rural Utility Service. We had gone back to D.C. in December, meeting with them on Cook Inlet Power Link and on Bradley Lake, and while we were there, they notified us that we were successful in a $2 million high-cost loan or grant for rural Alaska for bulk fuel. And with that, we continue to work with them. And they said they had another $5 million that they could make available to us. And when I was there last month, we signed it. And so they provided $5 million for maintenance improvements for additional communities for bulk fuel. And so again, this helps extend the life of these. And so I would say that, you know, $105 million is not a bad turnaround in the last 12 months that we've had. And, actually USDA, $5 million. But if we had not gone back there asking for $400 million, they wouldn't have given us $5 million. So it worked out for us.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Schrage, through the chair. Mr. Thayer, go back one page to 15. I've mentioned this before. Talk about bulk fuel upgrades. This is a great example of showing improvement. Obviously, we know that this improvement is necessary. But I see a $1 billion number there for deferred maintenance. I'm assuming that, that number could probably be even higher if we look across the state as a whole. I want to know what kind of measures we're putting in place so that the bottom left picture that we have there that shows this brand new fuel storage facility doesn't end up looking like the one on the top left sooner than it should. So these are massive investments we're making. Ultimately, $1 billion in deferred maintenance is a big number, and that's going to continue to be a problem if we don't have a plan in place. And I just want to know from the AEA's perspective, what is our plan on this to make sure that we're not only recapitalizing into these projects as we move forward for these new projects, but that we're also properly maintaining them.
Thank you. And through the chair, I do have to give credit. Tim Sandstrom, the chief operating officer, he's responsible for our rural programs, and he's put a lot of the measures in place for this. One of the things that AEA started several years ago, and that is doing an inventory and assessment of all the powerhouses and all the bulk fuel, where we've done 3D modeling and physically visited all the sites, know the current conditions of those sites, and have those inventoried so we have them on a proper list. But in addition to that, with that 3D modeling, we're able to do remote training and also resolve issues at the power plants or bulk fuel. We can easily do a presentation on it, but we can zero into a valve and be looking at it with the technician there and help handle how to handle that situation or what they might have, powerhouse or bulk fuel. One of the other thing that we do is the legislature helps fund, and that is provide training. And we generally take people to AvTech from the villages to come out and do the training. So we have people on the grounds that know using both bulk fuel and powerhouse. The one thing I will say here that is troubling, and that is the instructors that have been at AvTech are retiring, and the AvTech has not identified new people to help take up that. And if we're going to put brand new facilities in rural Alaska, we need to provide the training for them and not have, and even though AvTech, you know, and it's not their fault, but we need to work with them to get qualified people to do the training. We've depended on some, and they're retiring, which is great. But that's a very long answer. So we do the inventory assessment. We do the real life with our technicians, but we also provide training in rural Alaska for it too. And AvTech, which is also responsible for 50 communities on their own. They're outside of our jurisdiction, so to speak. They actually run those utilities.
Follow-up, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shruggie, through the chair, Ms. Thayer. Thank you for that. I guess one of the concerns I have is we put in this brand new facility, and we know that these require periodic inspections on a schedule. They require maintenance, continued maintenance, making sure that we're taking care of corrosion control, which is the number one enemy to these fuel farms, water ingress into the tanks, and corrosion control, and making sure we're doing appropriate inspections. So when this new facility goes in, is there a plan in place to make sure that those things are being done? And is the AEA being a direct participant to make sure that we're actually following up?
Through the chair, just for clarification, AEA does not own these facilities. We will take site control, build them, and then give them back to the community. But yes, we do leave a plan behind. We check on them regularly. We also partner with the Denali Commission and other, like AvTech, who has about 50 communities in rural Alaska. So it is a focused effort to make sure that we stand up and get the work done on the new facilities as well as keeping the old ones running. So yes, we do have it. But again, our team, our circuit rider team, is 4 people. And they travel rural Alaska, and it's not uncommon to have an electrical emergency and have to on the same night with only 4 people.
Yeah. Co-Chair Shruggie, Mike, just as a brief indulgence, I understand that the AEA doesn't own these facilities, but we're making potentially a $1 billion investment, and the cost of doing maintenance and then making sure these things are being done is a massive savings to the state of Alaska. So
if we don't have any kind of systematic plan in place to ensure that we're going to be caring for these facilities when we pay the, or put this kind of investment into it, I think that we should be looking at making sure that we have that plan in place. And if that costs us money to do that up front, we need to know those costs so that we can appropriately set that funding aside so that we aren't going to be stuck with premature failure of facilities and making sure that we're going to avoid all of the negative impacts, not only to reliable power in the communities, but to the environmental impact that could potentially occur. So appreciate you indulging me for a moment there.
Okay. And Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. My question is similar with these bulk fuel tanks in regards to the Renewable Energy Fund. Now, we saw in the previous slide that there has been a reduction of 120 million gallons of diesel fuel. Are you scaling these tank farms back in relation to the amount of energy produced or not produced with the diesel fuel?
Through the chair, that's a great question. It's a multi-pronged on a couple of points. When we go in for powerhouse or for a bulk fuel replacement, we're sizing it for the community for which they need at the time. Our biggest thing with bulk fuel is we want to make sure that these communities do not have to fly in fuel, which is $17, $18 a gallon, at this extreme cost. But as communities displace diesel, then we're sizing it appropriately, but we also want to make sure that even if they do not have that renewable online, that at 40 below, they do have the diesel online. But we are trying to coordinate that. And then the other issue that we don't deal with, but we work with the Denali Commission on and ANTHC, and that is when they put in new sewer and water, that usually puts additional demands on the powerhouses. And so the coordination is very important because we could have a plan to go in and build this certain size, and then somebody has a plan 2 years later to do sewer and water, and we have a plant that's not sized appropriately. So that's a constant coordination issue that we have, that we are challenged with, I should say.
Yeah, follow up.
Yep, follow up.
So it sounds like you're kind of designing these systems to maybe expand or contract, depending on the sources. Okay. Thank you very much.
And through the chair on that point, the powerhouses that we install are more fuel efficient. And so usually 10 to 15%. So that has to be taken into account. But again, the bulk fuel is where we want to make sure we're not flying in fuel and the community can survive for a period of time, through a winter with the tanks that they do have.
Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi. And Mr. Thayer, I know this is the question I'm going to ask is not your responsibility, but I've started to think all the communities that are dependent on bulk fuel purposes, the Alaska disconnect of right now, price of fuel going up, and at the time of purchase comes early summer when most communities do their bulk fuel purchases. I could foresee us in a good for our economy, bad for local economy scenario where folks can't afford to fill their bulk fuel purchase because the price is really high. Are there any programs that can help these small local remote utilities to bridge that economic of if they need to buy it the 1st of June and the price is way higher than they budgeted for and they can only buy half their fuel, but we know that they're going to need that fuel for the winter. So even though we have the storage capacity, we don't have the economics to buy full capacity. I hope it's not going to happen, but...
Through the chair, a couple of points on that. The timing is impeccable. One of the challenges that we see is the PCE program might not have enough funding with the increase in oil prices, and we're trying to determine what the potential spring orders are. It's not something we do, but we're reaching out to determine that with the Power Cost Equalization Program. And that is the Power Cost Equalization Program used to provide 500 kilowatts a PCE. The legislature, in a policy decision several years ago, moved that to 750. There was no additional funding that was put with that increase. And so as people are using the 750 kilowatts and the price of home heating, the price of diesel has gone up. We're this year at a point where we don't think there's going to be enough money in the earnings. We've tagged it. It's in the budget. It's a language issue. We've flagged it in the budget. So that is a concern, because the one thing that you know, and it's again, it's a policy call from the legislature, but it's very difficult at some point that you tell local communities that we have to prorate your PCE. And so that is a concern because of these increased oil prices. For communities that don't have enough funding for them, there is a program within the Department of Commerce and within the DCRA or Community Regional Affairs, where they have a loan program where communities can borrow money, and they provide loans to help communities that don't have enough to get them through to get their purchase. So there is a program on the purchase price, but the PCE is a larger question because, again, the oil prices and the spring delivery, depending if they've locked those prices down in the fall or if some of them are open to the market obviously has dramatically changed.
Thank you. I'm sad to say that I hadn't thought about the PCE ramifications. There's enough things keeping me awake at night. There's one more.
And through the chair, just on the PCE for it, it's a five-year look back on earnings. And so the earnings have always, you know, we've been doing around $45 million, $46 million on the earnings with that five-year. And it was averaging. And so, but it's just this year we look to be exceeding that by a few million dollars. So
really cold winter, really high prices. Thank you very much. Sorry, Mr. Co-Chair, I blurted out without acknowledging.
It's quite all right. Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you. Just wanted to follow up on Representative Bynum's question regarding maintenance of tank farms and making sure that their investments are being protected and they're here for a long time. And I've actually I saw what Scammon Bay, by the way, just as an aside, looked like before these newer pictures, seeing those in person, and amazing. I mean, this just looks so incredible. What I saw before was, it just looked like something out of a movie with, you know, tank farms that were standing upright. But it looked like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, you know, and it was not a good thing. And then, of course, we had the Murbach, and that didn't help because all those tanks are just mere yards from the ocean. And so that wasn't good either. But the question I had was, I'm just doing a little bit of research here, and it looks like ADEC no longer regulates tank farms below 420,000 gallons from what I'm reading here. And I'm curious, here in Scammon Bay, this looks like it's probably below 420,000, in which case it sounds like maybe the EPA regulates. And so I've got a couple questions, and if these are too technical, then we can take this off to a later conversation. But maybe if I could finish the questions. The first one was, is it the EPA who regulates? And if it's still the ADEC, I'm just curious how often folks go in to inspect these, because the corrosion issue is a real concern. And you want to make sure that, you know, before they get too bad, you know, maybe you're going in, maintenance being done, you're grinding off the corrosion, the rust, and then you're repainting them. But how often are these inspections being done? Also, is there any requirement that money be set aside, the local communities to do the work? And I guess maybe that's those are my questions.
Through the chair, or you are the chair, Mr. Co-Chair. On the one thing, a lot of the inspections are done by the Coast Guard, and that's who we partnered with. And your second question was, I'm sorry.
Whether or not the communities have, and I think the Coast Guard, I wonder if that's maybe for the coastal communities, but what about interior communities? And then the other question regarding the setting aside funds, so that if maintenance is required, then the funds are there, that the communities have those, or is that, you know, is it the expectation that the state comes in and helps to pay for that?
Right. I will get you through the, Mr. Co-Chair, I will get you the answer on who regulates what So we can easily do that. As far as like a reimbursement fund or a refund, no, there is not that in rural Alaska, primarily because that would add additional cost to the already high cost, has been the theory behind it. And so the state has taken the approach over the years that they will go in and repair and replace. But ironically, as funding goes down, it's usually rural Alaska that take kind of the first hit. And the majority of the funding that we received in the last 6 to 8 years is federal funding to help with the help with these costs. But no, there's not any type of an account set aside.
Any follow-up there, Coach Foster?
Oh, I just wanted to say I appreciate all the work that's going in into these some of these tank farms. I think the lifespan of these are probably going to be much longer than what used to be there because, you know, the better paints that are resistant to the corrosion. We've got, you know, the enclosures here to keep, you know, ocean water out and any contamination that, you know, if you had a spill, then it stays in the area here. I think the technology is better. Just everything, it's good to know that in a community you've got, you know, you can depend on these systems as opposed to what was there before. And it was like, you just never know. I mean, one storm away and the whole community could be without, you know, and if that happens in the fall and then you're going right into a winter, it could be catastrophic. So anyway, just appreciate all the work that you guys are doing. Thank you.
All right, please continue. I think we have one slide left.
Yep. We've done that one. This is our circuit rider program. This is where we talk about our four gentlemen who travel rural Alaska. Last year, they've done 50 on-site visits. If you notice, a couple of the communities, Avtech and Seward should not be there. But anyhow, some have more. It's kind of our frequent flyers where we know where we have challenges. And do that. And then the circuit rider real-time remote assistance, the 243 responses. This is something that might have been where we would have to fly out to rural Alaska that now we can handle because we have the inventory assessment and the 3D modeling of them. And then I do have just on this is our federal funding slide. This is the federal funding that we've received to date. Or I should say in the last 3 or 4 years, we have Alaska grants totaling $476 million. We have match secured of $89 million. That is the largest is the $50 million AEA grant, but the rest is funding by the legislature. And then the match needed, the only match outstanding is the $142 million for the SIP link, which again, we're looking at financing. We do have a couple of outstanding requests. We do have a federally congressionally directed spending request in with Senator Murkowski, primarily for rural Alaska on some projects. And then there's also a grant that we applied for Dixon Aversion that's worth up to $5 million. But again, those are pending grants. We look for opportunities and apply where necessary and love the ones that don't require a match.
Great.
And then that basically is your AEA team.
Very good. Representative Bynum, you have a question.
Thank you, Co-Chair Shragi, through the chair. Mr. Thayer, thank you. Appreciate the presentation today. I'm sure that we could probably be sit here for many hours and talk about these items. Two things. One of the things that I didn't notice on the slide, and I think is probably valuable information to the committee, is that when we are making investments through grants or directive spending that we have, an example of it would be the REF program and other programs that we have, is to indicate how much money the partners that we have are bringing to the table. Because I know that we do have spending shown in some of the slides here, and some of the communities that this money is going toward, as an example, I know for certain are putting a lot of their own money and their own resources and other federal money that are going into those projects. And so it'd be kind of nice for the committee to see that the amount of money that we're making for investments isn't just what we see here today, but that we do have community partners. And so that's good. The second thing is, one thing I didn't see an update on here, and I was hoping that at some point we would be able to get an update on it. I would hope that our co-chairs would ask for the AEA to bring is an update on the Susitna-Watonna project and what kind of a benefit that might bring, plus whether or not there are federal dollars that are directly tied to that or potentially tied to that. My understanding is there's potentially billions of dollars tied to that project. And if we aren't talking about that kind of an investment in this state, I think that we probably aren't doing our due diligence as a committee. So I don't know if that's been requested of you yet, but if there's an opportunity to get an update on that, that would be fantastic.
Okay. Additional questions from committee members? I want to make sure we have time for our next action item. Not seen.
Actually, Co-Chair Josephson. A quick comment. I wanted to thank the director. He hosted an event for legislators in the interim. I'm going to say it was October or something like that. Mm-hmm. There were many legislators in attendance, and we were all, to the individual, impressed by the shop he runs and what a great job he does.
That's great.
And I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Thank you.
Yes, so it's a team effort.
Yes, I was unable to attend this summer's visit, but I did do that in a prior year and have a similar takeaway. And on the last photo is that COO Sandstrom in the very, very back there hiding. Yes.
Yes.
How appropriate. Very good. Well, thank you both very much for being here today. Appreciate the presentation. We're now going to take a brief at ease as we transition over to our next item. We're at ease.
Okay, House Finance back on record at 2:40 p.m. on Thursday, March 19th, 2026. And next up, we have our final item of the day, and that is House Bill 210. That's the Peace Officers and Firefighters Disability Bill by Representative Kopp. This is our first hearing on the bill, so we will hear an introduction and then we'll take invited testimony, and then we will set the bill aside. So with that, I'd like to invite up Representative Kopp as well as his trustee staff, Ms. Julia O'Connor. And if you could both put yourselves on the record, thanks for being here, and go ahead and get us started.
Thank you, Chair Foster and members of the House Finance Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present House Bill 210. My name is Chuck Kopp. I'm representative for House District 10, and I'm accompanied by Ms. Julia O'Connor, my team member here. Committee members, House Bill 210 addresses a clear and consequential gap that we don't believe the legislature ever intended in our current disability benefit system, so the current employee plan that we have now. Specifically, it addresses the occupational disability benefits for peace officers and firefighters who are permanently injured in the line of duty. And the bill makes a targeted adjustment to the disability benefit level within the existing disability system to ensure that public safety employees who experience career-ending injuries are not pushed into financial instability at the exact moment that they need support the most. So our current system, moving to that slide, under PERS, the Public Employee Retirement Plan, and under TERS, our Teachers Retirement System, your disability benefits vary depending on your retirement tier. So members in the current tier that we're in now, which is PERS Tier 4 and TERS Tier 3, those are the defined contribution plans, are only eligible for occupational disability benefits. And they do not receive non-occupational disability coverage or retiree health coverage while disabled. Now, keep in mind that 85% of disabilities occur off the job. Think about stroke or cancer or a hunting accident or pretty much anything that is non-occupational. So the benefits that are covered are the 15% under occupational, and that is what our current defined contribution plan covers. So House Bill 210 does not restructure that. It does not restructure the retirement system, nor does it expand eligibility to more persons. It simply adjusts the benefit level for occupational disability for peace officers and firefighters that is already permitted under current law. So from a fiscal perspective, the population affected by this bill is very small. Currently in PERS, there's about 3,500 total peace officer or public safety employees broadly. Of those, 2,500 are peace officers and a little over 1,000 are firefighters. But across all employee classifications in the retirement systems we have today, of those who are on disability, just to give you some numbers, 21 members currently receive a defined benefit occupational disability, and 16 members in the defined contribution plan are on occupational disability. So today we have 47 employees that are on occupational disability. Now you might ask next, well, how many of those are public safety? 12. 12 are peace officers or firefighters in the defined contribution system, and then there's 4 in the defined benefit system. So a total of 12 employees in the plan we have now and 4 from the previous retirement system. That's the number that we're looking at that House Bill 10 would apply to in its current form. So it demonstrates that this legislation addresses a very small, identifiable group of individuals who experience career-ending injuries while performing public safety duties. Now you may say, well, why are you going after this for such a small group of employees? Well, for one, they came forward. We heard testimony in previous committee from troopers and police officers and firefighters who had career-ending. Some of them struggled just to come back from the brink of death but are permanently disabled, and told the story of going to 40% of their income and losing their health care overnight, and not realizing that that was the deal in the plan that they had, that if they were hurt in the line of duty, they would lose 60% of their income because the disability is at 40%, and they would lose their health care because to be on disability, you have to be separated from employment. So that was a red flag, and in discussion and review of committee notes going all the way back to 2005, we could not find any legislative intent that that's what the legislature actually was trying to do with that. So in looking at key considerations, I think for finance, is what are the status of the disability trust funds today? How well are they funded? The Alaska Retirement Management Board just audited our disability trusts. The PERS for public safety, for public employee retirement system, is funded at 421% right now. And the TERS disability trust for our teachers is at 6,951% funded. So in other words, the projected liabilities don't come close to the assets that are currently in those accounts. And the funds do exist for this purpose, to provide disability protection for members who are injured in the line of duty. So this legislation does not create a new fund or benefit program. It simply adjusts the benefit level within the existing disability trust structure. I would just note on this slide, you can see there that in PERS Tier 4 and TERS Tier 3, if you are hurt in the line of duty, you have an occupational disability, you do lose your health care, and you do not qualify under non-occupational for any disability benefits. So it's a double whammy. I'll give you some examples. You can have a public safety officer who has 17, 18 years of service, or if you want to even look at a teacher, a whole separate job class, 28 years in the classroom, and they have cancer or a stroke. That's non-occupational. So they are not able to be employed anymore. They go on disability and they lose their health care all at the same time. So it's a real issue. So this next slide kind of highlights, well, what do the numbers look like in for the people? So currently, a peace officer or firefighter who becomes permanently disabled in the line of duty receives 40% of their salary at the time of separation. So it's a 60% drop in pay. And that occurs at a time they can no longer work in their profession due to the occupational injury. And so for families who are already kind of reeling with the medical costs and recovery and the severe financial strain, it's a real whammy, especially for those in Tier 4 who also lose all their health care when that happens. So what the bill proposes, a potential solution, is to increase the occupational disability benefit for peace officers and firefighters after the first 12 months of disability. So the bill doesn't change anything for the first year. The law now says once you are determined to be in a disability status, you get 40% of your base pay. The bill doesn't change that. But after the end of that first year, if the medical review board, which is required to review your status and say you're still permanently disabled, if you, at that annual audit, you still are in disability, then you would go to 75% disability. That, again, is not addressing health care. That is just an increased payment to more accurately reflect what is going on in those families and in those members' costs. And we've also applied this to the four people who are in the DB tier, because this also is the same with them. They are also on that 40% disability income permanently. So whether you're a DC or a DB, the total of those 16 employees this would apply to. It does apply to individuals currently receiving occupational disability benefits, all 16 of those members, which I talked to you about, when the bill would take effect. We believe that this ensures that public safety employees that are already living with permanent occupational injuries are treated more fairly under the updated benefit level. So this next slide shows what that financial impact would be. A firefighter earning $6,000 per month who becomes permanently disabled would receive approximately $25,000 a year more in disability after the first year if they requalified to still be on disability. And of course, this additional support income helps maintain household stability for families that suddenly lose a career income. I would note that the Alaska Retirement Management Board just this year introduced a resolution saying that we should actually do this for all employee classes in the defined contribution plan, and the actuary modeled that increased cost, and the health trust and the disabilities trust are still significantly overfunded, even if we did it for every single defined contribution employee. And they actually included health care in that too. Again, this bill doesn't do it. It's targeted at peace officers and firefighters. Just increasing the disability benefits issue. It does not address the health care plan. But I only say that because I wanted the committee to be aware the onboard actuary just modeled this for every employee existing in the defined contribution plan and found that these funds were still overfunded. And the reason why is we don't have a significant number of people out on disability. These are small numbers. So we feel this is a very targeted, narrow approach to deal with the people who have literally sacrificed everything to keep our community safe, and is reasonable as a response to them protecting us, that we are reaching out and saying, hey, if this happens to you, we're gonna show the disability benefit is more commensurate with what you're going through. So I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thank you very much. In line, I do have four people. That's Representative Tomaszewski, Josephson, Hannon, and Bynum. I don't think I've missed anybody. Representative Stapp. Okay, Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Thank you for being here and presenting this. So when you become disabled, can you like give me a definition of disability? Is there a percentage? Who determines your disability? And is there a percentage? Is it 100% disabled? Is there a 50% disabled? And is any of that addressed in here?
Yes. So to be occupationally disabled for the sake of disability benefits, you won't be separated from employment unless you're considered 100% disabled for the purpose of returning to that job class. So can't be a police officer, you can't be a firefighter anymore. So they have to, you know, let you go, separate from employment, and you're on disability. And the determinant is the medical officers that work with the Division of Retirement Benefits that and the Disability Trust to make that determination through medical evaluation.
Okay, follow up. Okay, thank you for that. So when you would become, you're talking about healthcare now, when you become permanently disabled, are there any other benefits out there like Medicare or Medicaid or any other benefits for healthcare that would actually pick up some of those benefits?
So, yes, through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I'm learning to pronounce that correctly, Representative. So, yeah, and your point is well taken that it's a cost shift. Either you cost shift to public assistance because it doesn't exist right now for the employee. So the only option wouldn't be for, unless you're kind of 65 or more, it would actually be Medicaid or TANF or SNAP, but it would be these public assistance programs that these people would have to fall back onto. That is, right now there is no other, you know, even somebody might say, well, what about Social Security? That is possible, but it is very hard to access, we have found, and very difficult to qualify for and get. And it's a very significant process to qualify for Social Security disability. So hope I'm answering your question.
Okay, thank you. And just one more quick.
Representative Tomaszewski.
So the on page 5, the first year only being at the 40%, why would you want to keep that? Why not go directly to 75%? It seems like that would be the hardest year to get through, but we're keeping it at the 40% level. Is there a reason why you wouldn't just go to the 75% on that first year?
Representative Kopp.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. So in keeping with the current law and that time period of evaluation, is somebody going to remain on disability? We decided that was reasonable. Believe me, I mean, empathetically, I'm with your line of questioning 1,000%. I mean, if someone's actually separated from employment and in disability status, I would have no problem with just putting them at the 70%. Otherwise, they would have never been moved to a disability status, had a medical review board not said, you're not coming back to work. So I think your point is very well taken. I simply followed the process that was in the law now, which is at the end of the first year, you're reevaluated, and then moved it at that point, looking to take the most conservative path. But I think your suggestion, I couldn't argue against that.
Yeah, just a comment. Yeah, it just seems like that would be the hardest year to get through.
Yeah.
Right. Losing your employment at that point. But okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next up, Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Cobb, good to see you. If we go to slide 2, just so I understand here, the bill would change nothing in rows 1 and 2. The focus is on rows 3 and 4. And it would move the no's under non-occupational disability to yeses. Is that right?
So it would raise the continuous disability benefit level now, which is at 40%. Yep. for both the four people in the defined benefit plan that are on it right now,
okay,
with the state employees that are on it,
yep,
they would also be eligible to go up to 70%. And then the 12 defined contribution members would be able to, after the end of the first year and requalifying medically for disability, would be allowed to go to the 70% level. So it would affect both those tiers. Did I get that right? Okay.
A follow-up?
And you said in the column four where it says healthcare during, that doesn't change, I think you noted.
That is correct. Yes.
But in column three, it would now say for tiers four PERS, tiers three TERS, that would become occupational and non-occupational?
No, this bill only adjusts the benefit level for occupational disability.
Okay.
It did not pick up non-occupational. I just, as an aside, mentioned that the ARM board just had this evaluated to include non-occupational, actually for all employees in the DC plan, and they found that the healthcare trust and the disability trust were still overfunded doing that.
So, follow up. So an injured police officer, I recall earlier in my time here, there was a police officer named Beagle, I believe, who noted a neighbor of mine who said that when an officer is injured and not able to work for, God willing, a shorter period of time, their defined benefit is frozen. They're not earning anything toward it. And he found that troublesome. But just in that context, the officer who must separate permanently, they have no health insurance. They could be very young, way away from Medicare. And all they get at that point, even though their accident or injury or health crisis, well, in some instances, it's not work-related. In some, it is. They do not get in health insurance at all. Is that what your testimony is?
Yes, there is no state of Alaska health care plan that follows you when you're separated from employment and you're on disability status. That is correct.
Follow.
Representative Joseph.
And that's so even if it was an occupational injury.
Under the defined benefit here, you would have health care. But under the plan that we're now in since 2006, you lose your health care if you are in disability status. So you lose 60% of your income. And you lose your health care as a result of a line of duty injury. Yes,
last
sir.
Question.
Representative Joseph.
It begs the question, and I know you're not here necessarily to discuss it, but HB 78 doesn't change dramatically, as I understand it, the health care benefits. So it's not that bill. It's apropos of this bill because it's top of mind. That bill doesn't fix that problem either, correct? In other words, the injured worker, injured on the job, doing what they were supposed to do, but they suffer an injury, which anyone could suffer, there's no health insurance in any bill for these individuals.
Representative Josephson, so through the chair, so yes, it does fix that. It does bring back a health care benefit when you have an occupational injury, which has been lost in the DC plan that we're at now.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. In line, I've got Representative Hannon, Bynum, Stapp, Galvin, and Allard. It was Moore than Allard. Okay. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Representative Kopp, I think you rattled off at the beginning on page two the total number of people in the Tier 4 PERS and the Tier 3 TERS currently on occupational disability. Could you reprise those numbers for me?
Representative Kopp?
Yes, Representative Hannon, I sure can. Let me refer back to my notes here. So across all employee classifications in the Defined Contribution Plan who are on occupational disability right now, there are 16. 16 defined contribution members are on occupational disability, and across the defined benefit plan on occupational disability, there are 21. So we have a total of 47 current employees that the state is responsible for that are on DC.
Right. Co-Chair Foster, follow up. I guess my only concern is that we're not for this very few. I want to see us do it for all our occupational disabilities. You know, the sad truth is we lose more public employees to fatal injuries that are not law enforcement. You know, helicopter crash on the North Slope a couple summers ago took 3 DNR employees. Because of the nature of our public employees who work in planes, boats, aircraft, you know, God forbid a teacher shot in their classroom. And it is a very small number. So I'd like to see this bill expanded to incorporate occupational injury, permanently disability, that you can't continue to work, because we're not fixing the fatalities, but folks, they're not going, you know, I'm okay with all the other provisions, but it just seems like such a small number that if we're going to fix it, let's fix it for everyone who is injured occupationally because of their work and is permanently disabled. And by, you know, I'd agree with Representative Tomaszewski. Like to see us go that first year while they're still trying to get qualified for Social Security disability, probably, which is about an 18-month process. Because for all 16 of those folks, all 16, this job-related injury, you know, and I just think of car accidents, boat accidents, airplane accidents that take because people were doing their jobs and then permanently disabled. I'd like to see this expanded.
Representative Kopp, any thoughts?
I'm empathetic with the representative. So thank you, Representative Hannon. Again, we're talking about very small numbers, and what the ARM board actually suggested is, like I said, expanding this to all employee classes in the defined contribution plan, and they went further. They said it should be expanded to non-occupational too, because there are so few people even under both categories, and they just recommended for non-occupational you have a minimum of 10 years of service to qualify for non-occupational. So they had some sideboards on it, but it's a worthy discussion. And by bringing forward this bill, I'm not trying to be discriminatory against other employee class. Obviously, I'm a retired public safety officer here in Alaska. I'm certainly very sensitive to the line of duty risks that they take. I do believe that I concur with the ARM board, and there is another House Finance Committee bill, House Bill 378, that actually has all these fixes in that bill, which we hope to present soon. But and that would be in that bill, Representative Hannon. Yeah.
Okay. Next question is Bynum, then Stapp, Galvin, Moore, and Allard. So again, Representative Bynum.
Co-Chair Foster, if it's okay, I'll wait until after Representative Stapp goes. I know he has a pressing appointment or a deadline coming up here.
Okay, Representative Stapp.
I think Co-Chair Foster, the Chair, Rep. Kopp. Thanks for being here. So I guess my first question is, I'm struggling with the terminology. In the insurance world, like own occupation is better than any occupation. So when you talk about disability. So basically, if a police officer is deemed an occupational disability, that means we will pay them disability benefits because they can't be a police officer. That doesn't mean they can't get another job and still collect those disability benefits. Is that correct through the chair?
Through the chair, Chair Foster. So actually it's correct, kind of. The problem is at the current level of disability, even at 40%, a lot of that disability is disallows you from taking other income, or you will lose that disability. So it disincentivizes someone who even says, well, look, I can come back and work as an investigator, sit at a desk. My back is broke, but I can certainly work a telephone. So you're kind of locked into that unless you get a substantially higher paying job than that 40% of your base pay. So they're kind of caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, so to speak, on that.
Yeah, follow up, Mr. Coacher.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Coacher Foster, through the chair to wrap up. Yeah, that's actually exactly where I was going, because I know, so in the insurance world, after 2 years, if you're totally disabled, you have to qualify, you have to apply for Social Security disability and your disability insurance will actually ratchet your payments down based on how much Social Security income you get for being disabled. So I'm curious, if you raise this to 75% and that individual also qualifies for Social Security disability, does that create any type of conflict? I'm just unfamiliar with this, the way we do this program through the chair.
So the Division of Retirement Benefits is online too, and I think this is their bailiwick, and they could talk to that. Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, if you could, Co-Chair.
Sure. Mr. Brandon Roomsburg, if you're online, if you can state your name and your title, and if you need the question asked again, we can do that.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Co-Chairs and members of the House Committee. This is Brandon Roomsburg, Retirement Manager for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. If the representative wouldn't mind, could he please restate the question?
Representative Stout.
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Foster's the chair to our wonderful folks at Retirement Benefits. So basically, if you raise to 25% and the or excuse me, 75% of wage for occupational disability, and the individual qualifies for Social Security disability later, are we creating any type of conflict in terms of their benefit getting ratcheted down because they make too much money? Because the world I come from, there's like laws that say you cap the amount of money an employee can get paid on disability. And I think there's actually a federal cap too, but I can't remember. So I'm just curious if you know that world through the chair.
Mr. Roomsburg.
Thank you for the question through the chair. I'm not aware of the Social Security benefits that a person's receiving affecting this. What I know is that if they recover from the injury or illness, or, you know, through things such as medical evidence or proof of capability to work in a comparable position is offered, sorry for my stalling. You know, to better answer your question, Representative Stapp, would I be able to please follow up with you?
Sure. Can I do a quick follow-up, Coach?
Sure, Representative Stapp.
Yeah, through the chair to our DRMB folks. I don't – so it's currently any occupation, right? I know I asked Rep. Kopp this a little bit, but it is your occupation. So if I'm injured as a police officer and you know, like the representative said, like I can't get another job because I lose my existing benefits. Would that apply? I mean, how do we fix that problem? Because that seems like something we should – maybe not have, like, because you should, if you can't be a, if you know, if you, I mean, if you fall off a ladder, like as a firefighter, and you can be like an Uber driver or something, I wouldn't want you to lose your disability benefits for, because you can't be a firefighter anymore. Does that make sense through the chair?
Mr. Roomsburg.
Thank you. Through the chair. Yes, that makes sense. So correct. It is due to any comparable position that the person may have become disabled from that could affect the benefits that they're receiving. In your example, if a person were a firefighter that falls off a chair and goes out and becomes an Uber driver, no, that work as an Uber driver would not affect the amount of the disability benefit that they're receiving.
Okay. Thanks.
Chair. Can you tell me who's speaking again on the
record? Sure. His name is Mr. Brandon Roomsburg, and he's the retirement manager with the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Okay, next up in the lineup, I've got Representative Bynum and then Galvin, Moore, and Allard. Representative Bynum.
Co-Chair Foster. Representative Stapp asked a really good question about Social Security benefits. I just wanted to say that most of our state employees are not in Social Security. And so I don't know that you can even get Social Security disability benefits if you've never paid into it. In fact, I'm almost positive that must be true. If you're not participating in the program, I don't think you're eligible for Social Security benefits. I just wanted to put that on the record.
That makes sense. Mr. Roomsburg, did you hear that comment? Just wanted to see if you had any thoughts.
Nope, I heard the comment, and through the chair, I heard Representative Kopp's comment, and he is accurate. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. Thank you, Representative Kopp and your staff for being here today. I was looking through the packet here, and I know there's some information provided from the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Specifically, there's a flyer here, and it says that it's for the defined benefits plan, retirement plans. And I was wondering if there was another information provided for the current other plans. That would be very helpful to have in our packet. But at the end of the day, I guess there's a first say thank you to all the folks that are out there working in these high-risk jobs. And I think that at any time we have, for example, a police officer or a firefighter or any of our other folks working for us in the state that are in these very dangerous jobs, as Representative Hannity mentioned a few, that when they get injured with disability in the line of duty, we have an obligation to take care of them, fully believe that. Disappointing about the health care. Obviously, that's something that needs to be looked at. But a lot of questions I have, and I know we're not going to be able to get to all of them today. The current plan, how is this current plan being paid for, and what do we anticipate for the cost of being able to adjust this for 75%?
Through the chair, so it's being paid for through the disability trusts, which I spoke to earlier, and the disability trust for the public employee retirement system is at 421% funded. It's got $98 million in the fund. And again, this is such an amount that when it's dealing with so few employees, it's not even a penny in the drum of water, so to speak, as far as displacing its viability.
So follow up.
Follow.
So right now the plan could be covered with, if we put this in the law right now, it would be covered. And this was a significant increase in a benefit for anybody that's considered disabled. But let's assume we move into the future and the plan doesn't have these funding levels available to it, because maybe more people are actually partaking or taking advantage of this plan because it is a higher payout. Where would those additional costs come from? Would it come from, does it come directly out of the PERS plan? And then if it's a non-state participant, so for example, a municipal police officer that's in the PERS plan, are those municipalities protected from additional cost?
Through the chair, so to your first question, these are actuarially modeled over 25 or a 30-year horizon, not based on a single one-time benefit increase and what might happen. They did model this benefit increase and what might happen, and the actuary report, which we'll get to the committee, showed that it materially does not deplete the strength of the funding scenario. So, again, the increase in benefit, you have to remember, going from 40 to 75% is doesn't do away with the medical review board process, which is very rigorous to determine disability status in the first place. And so I don't see a scenario where suddenly people are going to be trying to get disabled when they're still losing a substantial portion of their pay at work. And they're losing their health care. They have to be separated from their health care. And that, so two very big disincentives to do that. And the actuary that modeled this, Gallagher, same one works for state, modeled these scenarios out over that horizon. And it's very strong, robust, and able to handle this. Thank you.
Just a quick follow-up.
Follow-up.
In the flyer that was handed out for the PERS tiers 1 through 3, there is in here a vocational rehab requirement that's in here. Is that same requirement exist for all of the other covered employees?
Representative Cobb?
I don't have the defined contribution one in front of me right now. Actually, I take that back. I do. I'd have to get back with you for certain, Mr. Bynum, but or Representative Bynum, but my best guess is that it does, because vocational rehabilitation would be part of a disability, and are you going to come off it or not? But again, the Division of Retirement and Benefits is online. I would certainly defer to their expertise on this question.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I'm going to appreciate you bringing this forward. It's the first time we've heard it. Give us a lot of opportunity to go and seek additional information. I think I'll go do some homework. We won't do that homework here on the committee today, but I appreciate you presenting the opportunity for us to consider an enhanced benefit for our workers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, next up we've got Representative Moore and then Allard. Representative Moore.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Good to see you, Mr. Representative Kopp. So one of my questions here is, from what I understand, you don't have to terminate before applying for the disability, for the occupational disability benefit?
Through the chair, so you don't have to terminate, but you will be terminated if you're on disability, because you can't receive disability and have your job at the same time.
Okay, follow-up.
Follow-up.
And so what happens to the medical insurance side of that when you do terminate?
You, through the chair, you lose your health care because the employer no longer carries you on their health care plan when you're not contributing into it anymore as an employee.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Representative Ballard.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm having a moment. So if the person online, if they could, I have two questions and then I'll refer to Representative Kopp. Could they repeat the answer to the question and the answer to what Representative Stapp, he was speaking really loud or quick and I couldn't catch everything he said. Can we do that?
Sure. Mr. Roomsburg, if you could refer back to Representative Stapp's question and maybe repeat that to the best of your recollection and then answer that as well.
Through the chair, thank you, Brandon Roomsburg, retirement manager for DRB. I recall Representative Stapp's question being about comparable positions. He gave the example of a firefighter, for example, potentially falling from a ladder and becoming occupationally disabled. Would that prevent him from going out and gaining other occupations, such as an Uber driver? Would that affect the amount of benefits that he's receiving? And the answer is no.
Can I just do a quick follow-up on that?
Representative Ballard.
So, for example, if a police officer was to get injured, receives defined benefits currently or whatever the status, gets hurt but does a job but not as a police officer, they can still get defined benefits? I'm in favor of that. I'm just asking, can they still receive their defined benefits if they were to get a job that's basically sitting at a computer?
Mr. Roomsburg?
Through the chair, thank you for your question. That's correct. As long as it's not a comparable position to that from which they became disabled, then yes, it would not impact the amount of disability benefits they're receiving.
Just a couple. Okay. Thank you for that. And if you could possibly send me what the comparable jobs are, I would really appreciate it. And then maybe us as a whole, as a committee, could look at that.
Mr. Rooms.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. And through the chair, Representative Clapp, a couple of questions. Yeah. Can you keep saying it's a small percentage. It's fine. Can you just tell me what the number is? It helps me a little bit better.
Sure. There's 12 eligible employees now in the defined contribution plan that this bill would apply to. And there's 4 eligible employees now in the defined benefit plan that this bill would apply to.
So that would lead into my follow-up. Is it possible? So you clearly probably have the numbers from the year before, possibly the year before. What I'm looking at doing, because we don't actually know the cost on it, is it possible to look at backdating, meaning folks that were impacted by this 24 months and then move up? There's got to be some sort of cutoff, but I don't necessarily think it's right that we can't at least scoop in some.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Ballard, I really appreciate that. And so the bill now applies to anybody who's on disability right now. So in a way, it kind of does backdate in that it would immediately apply to them. I think what you're saying is, could we go back to when they first got on it and kind of make them whole according to the bill?
Yeah.
And I would defer to my Julia. Is that an amendment or what do we need to do on that?
For
Ms.
the record,
O'Connor.
Julia O'Connor, staff to Representative Kopp, through the chair, Representative Ballard. This is a retroactive bill, but it would not be back paid.
So, thank you. Can I do a quick follow-up?
Representative
Ballard. Interesting. So, retroactive would mean they can get care but not back pay? Like, how does that – I'm comparing to the military. For example, if you put in your disability – and for some reason you're denied or you don't follow up or you don't follow through. The military, it could be 20 years. For me, it was 9 years. I said, I piled it. I got the runaround. I just gave up. What the military did is they came back and they said, you can't give up. We're going to back pay you, which was great. The 8 or 9 years that you missed. So they try to make you whole because that's a lot of time. I understand there's no back pay, but what is they making the whole part? Like, is there medical bills or like, what are we looking at?
Ms. O'Connor.
Julie O'Connor, staff to Representative Kopp through the chair. When I say retroactive, I mean it will include going forward all 16 folks.
Okay.
And they will get it, but it will not be as back paid as like when, how long they've been on disability.
Yeah, and through the chair, Representative Kopp, Representative Allard, again, I really appreciate your question. So in a kind of in a retroactive sense, it's not requiring only future people who go into disability are eligible. It says even if you're already in disability status, it applies to you. And to more narrowly get at your question is, you know, how far back can you do the improvement? And that could probably be taken care of through an amendment. But right now, my understanding is the effective date of the bill is when it would go into place for people currently on disability.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. We've got Representative Jimmy and then Bynum. Representative Jimmy.
Guyana Co-Chair Foster. It's more of a comment, really. I just wanted to thank the maker of the bill for coming here and speaking on it, and just wanted you to know that this is important. And for me, it's very important for rural because there's so many barriers of going out there being a teacher. There's so many challenges for being a trooper out there. With teachers, it's with multiple barriers, these are one of them. You have teachers coming to the village, connecting with students, connecting with the community, but then they have no retirement benefits, and that's not taking care of themselves. And I have many teachers calling me in tears saying they had no choice but to leave because there is no defined benefits. And because you have to look out for yourself in your career and make sure you have a proper exit plan, proper plan for your future. And as well for troopers, I know we spend about $50,000 to train them. And because they have no retirement benefits, they'd rather go somewhere else where there is one. And I just want to thank you for bringing this forward, and it is important. My only wish and hope is that we could come up with a solution in the future for this to also benefit our VPSOs, regional police village officers, our VPSOs, our RPOs, our VPOs, TPOs. So I have to work with that.
Yes, through the chair, thank you very much, Representative Jimmy. And I do want to work on a solution for our VPSOs. As we know, being employed by a nonprofit makes it harder when we're talking about a state disability program, but there has to be things that we can do. I just noticed that today was the anniversary of VPSO Thomas Madoli being shot and killed in Manicotic. Their line of duty sacrifices are very significant to our state, and your point is very well taken. Thank you.
Any follow-up, Representative Jimmy?
No.
Okay. Next up, we have Representative Bynum and then Allard. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, Representative Kopp. The on this particular slide, we're talking about the healthcare duration, during the disability. It is not provided for the two categories at the end there. Is the health insurance that is being provided, is that coming from the same disability trust?
Go ahead.
Julie O'Connor through the chair. So that is coming through the retiree medical trust. So whenever we're talking about PERS and TERS and the health care is overfunded, it would be coming out of that. But for just to the DCR folks, the defined contribution, they do not get any kind of health care. So once they're terminated, they're at no health care is provided.
This is a quick follow-up for clarification. So the element of the health care is specifically a separate item from the health care trust. And the what we're talking about here is from the disability trust for funding the pay.
Through the chair, Julia O'Connor, that is correct.
Okay. And then one other quick follow-up for just clarification.
Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. to either one of you. When we talk about disability, the way that I read this is that it says that disability from being able to do the job that you're in. So if you're a police officer, for example, and you were involved in a car accident that disabled your leg in such a way that you're not able to continue performing policing duties as you were in that classification, you technically could be considered 100% disabled from doing that duty. On the other side of that, you could have a police officer that is involved in a shooting and is paralyzed from the neck down. And my understanding is in both of those scenarios, they would treat both of these people in the same way. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Bynum. So, yes, if you're on a disability benefit again, you arrive at that status by a pretty rigorous medical review process. Then the nature of your injury is such that regardless, you are considered not able to go back to your job, and you have to be separated from employment by the employer. One other thing that we're seeing that happens is traumatic brain injury, where you still have motor movement, but you're fundamentally completely a different person, and your capacities are so diminished that you're just not able to do your job. And we have people that with line of duty injuries that are in this status right now.
Thank you.
And just for the record, that was Representative Kopp. Representative Bynum, do you have any?
No, I'm good for now. Thank you very much.
Okay, Representative Ballard.
Thank you. And again, it's for the gentleman on the line.
Mr. Roomsburg.
The question is, referencing back to a Representative Stapp's question, can you define what a comparable is when it comes to defining whether the person's in a comparable job? What's the definition of comparable?
Mr. Roomsburg.
Please.
Through the chair, thank you for the question. A comparable position may include a position that requires similar strengths and abilities to the position held by the member at the time of termination of employment, or a position that provides compensation of 75% or more of the salary used to calculate the member's occupational disability benefit.
That's good. Okay, thank you.
Okay, we've reached the end of our 2 hours here. And so I just want to give Representative Kopp the opportunity to wrap up any loose ends, if there are any, and otherwise we'll gavel out. But Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I really appreciate the committee's questions. I did want to highlight the earlier question raised by Representative Stapp about Social Security disability benefits. State employees don't get Social Security. They don't contribute into it, so there is no Social Security disability benefit they would qualify for. We feel like this is not creating a new fund or a new benefit. It's only addressing an existing benefit and adjusting it for a class of employees that are permanently injured in the line of duty, and addressing that gap in a way we think the legislature always meant, but somehow has just been overlooked. And I hope you would concur, and thank you so much for hearing the bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. It's a good introduction to the bill. So with that, we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow morning. That's March 19th at 9 a.m. And at that meeting, we'll start taking up amendments submitted for Senate Bill 64. That is the elections bill. So if there's nothing else to come for the committee, we will be adjourned at 3:30 p.m. Thank you.